Great Hunters, a sci-fi space opera, written by Gary Kaufman, read and produced by Andrew Kaufman. For more information about the author, book, or podcast, visit www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Great Hunters podcast. I am your host, Andrew Kaufman. We have lots of exciting story for you today, 6 chapters to listen to. So, let's get right into it. Here is the story so far. In the last episode, we met Greg Black, a skilled personnel consultant that Warren Mathias had hired to select the geneticists he would use to begin staffing his new genetics lab. Ever the risk-taker, Mathias took Greg on a little joyride in his souped-up Lincoln Town Car. After realizing what kind of a man Mathias was, Greg took that information and was able to select several candidates that seemed to live up to Mr. Mathias's standards. After several interviews, Mathias selected Jane Parker, Art Brown, Walt Bennett, and Sarah Merchant as the first staff for the new lab. 6 months into their new jobs, Jane has grown into her role as the leader of the bunch, though she still participates in her climate activism, which has seen her in jail more than a time or two. Her other fellow geneticists expressed agreement with her points of view, to one degree or another. One day, Sarah and Jane were talking about what could be the quicker way to help reverse climate change, and Jane mentioned that, for the most part, the planet would be better off without men. They began gabbing about the faults and troubles that men have. Jane mentions that she could create a plague to kill off all men, though not entirely serious. Meanwhile, Mike is continuing his study of the planet Earth. More specifically, human beings. He notes that humans have advanced far faster than most other races, going from nomadic hunter-gatherer tribes to agrarian villages to a highly industrialized society that even has space travel in just a few thousand years. He also notes that emotion and ego seem to drive the intelligence that makes this species such a developmental dynamo. This seems to be driving the human race towards environmental disaster and more catastrophic wars. Their development continues to follow the paths of numerous races that have been studied over time, that of self-destruction. Though they have many fascinating and rich cultures, Mike is seeing disaster looming closer and closer for the human race. To top all that off, Mike has found himself growing more and more fond of humanity, something that his species definitely discourages. Chapter 11. Temptation. With his mosquito drones, Mike obtained DNA and RNA samples from hundreds of thousands of humans, and he paired this information with videos of those same humans going about their everyday lives. This yielded mountains of data. But Mike had powerful computers, and he had been trained to analyze it by the terabyte. In one analysis, he correlated all significant DNA variants with specific human behaviors. While most humans deny it, believing they have free will, he discovered much of human behavior is determined by their DNA. As the humans raced towards their own demise, an idea came to Mike. If acted upon, the idea would certainly violate the no-contact rule. But, he rationalized, there's a difference between thinking about something and actually doing it. This reasoning seduced him. He was exploring an idea. What if he could identify the biochemical mechanisms behind the human male's excessive tribalism and aggressiveness? He didn't want to remove all of it. But he thought there might be a way to suppress their genetic urges, perhaps to a level low enough to allow the humans to survive. Human scientists had previously identified 2 small almond-shaped parts of the brain, collectively named the amygdala, which they believed were important in mammalian emotional arousal. Mike's first step was to confirm that the amygdala was behind human tribalism and aggressiveness. If this was true, he might be able to find a way to selectively inhibit those aspects of the amygdala's function. Mike spent several months collecting data and reviewing human research. He confirmed that, within the amygdala, two separate groups of neurons, one in the left and one in the right, were responsible for activating tribalism and aggressive emotions. Next, Mike wanted to identify the critical neuroreceptors within the amygdala and find a way to keep them from being activated. These two tasks required an additional 3 years of data gathering and analysis. Eventually, Mike concluded that if he were to replace adenine and thymine with guanine and cytosine-based pairs at 13 sites in human DNA, the modified DNA would generate a new messenger RNA molecule. The messenger RNA molecule would then leave the nucleus, enter the cell cytoplasm, and order the ribosomes there to manufacture and release a tiny protein molecule. When released into the bloodstream, this molecule would find its way to the neuroreceptors in the amygdala and chemically bind to them. In theory, Mike thought, this would inhibit the neural triggers that lead human males to aggression and tribalism. When Mike started his research, he had told himself he was just exploring a hypothetical question. 4 years later, he had an answer. There was a way to dampen human male tribalism and aggression. It wouldn't be that hard to do. If he were to make this modification to the human germline, he believed the effects would be immediate, and all male offspring would inherit the modified DNA. As he watched humans ricochet from one crisis to another, and threats to human existence became more urgent, Mike's temptation to act grew stronger. Interference was prohibited, but Mike thought he could save the humans. His friend Garwig had faced the same dilemma, and he had chosen to save a civilization. Mike did not make decisions quickly, and this one cost him several nights' worth of sleep, while he mentally debated whether he should help the humans or passively observe what he fully expected to be a global catastrophe. Eventually, Mike reached a decision. He created a transmitter that allowed him to avoid his ship's communication system and sent messages through a channel that the Center for Exobiology had not foreseen, the Earth's internet. Then, he sent an email to one human. Afterwards, his conscience pained him, but that wasn't the worst part. The worst part was knowing that Professor Jurgen had been right all along. Chapter 12. Email from Mike. Sarah sat down in a chair beside Jane's desk.
I just got an email from some guy named Mike. He said he's a geneticist. I don't normally reply to people I don't know, but he knows what we're doing. I mean, it's like he's been in our lab.
How? Is this place bugged?
He didn't say,
Sarah said. Where's he from?
Dunno. I thought maybe China or Russia. Someplace where human germline engineering might be government-sponsored.
Why did he write to you?
He said he's discovered the genetic causes of aggressiveness and tribalism in human males.
You're kidding me!
Not a bit. He shared his human genome analysis, including links between genes and human behaviors. He's identified 13 specific base pair changes that will reduce men's aggressiveness and tribalism.
Is he right?
His understanding is well beyond mine, but as near as I can tell, the idea makes sense. We'd need to test it, of course, before we'd know for sure.
You mean on rats? Jane asked.
Yes. And after that, on humans.
Sounds too good to be true.
Can you send me his email?
Chapter 13. Drinks at Ralph's. It was a Thursday evening, and Jane, Sarah, and Art had stopped for drinks at Ralph's Bar and Grill. In a booth near the back of the restaurant, they chatted about the difficulties of creating immortality. However, midway through a glass of Merlot, Jane leaned towards Art and said,
Art, we've been keeping something from you.
Jane's words made him a bit apprehensive, and he thought she might have bad news. He blinked a couple of times and asked,
What's that?
Sarah and I were thinking about creating a plague to kill all men.
Art raised his eyebrows.
Why?
Men are going to kill all of us,
Jane said.
You mean wars and global warming?
Yes, and their unquenchable desire to make more and more babies.
Unsure if Jane was serious, Art asked,
"Well, what about Walt and me?"
"You're why we've decided not to."
Art shook his head.
"Jane, that's just plain scary. I mean, maybe you could create a man plague, but you'd be the worst mass murderer in history."
Sarah jumped into the conversation.
"She knows that. It'd be like killing half the population to save our species."
Incredulous, Art asked,
"You too, Sarah? Have you considered any other options?"
Jane said,
"We have one."
Art listened as Sarah explained the genetic adjustments that could tamp down male aggressiveness and tribalism.
"Where'd you get that idea?"
Art asked. Sarah told Art about her email conversations with Mike.
"We can't know for sure," Jane said. "But Sarah and I think he's right."
"Oh, God. You're serious. I mean, this is crazy."
"Crazy is waiting for men to annihilate us in a nuclear war," Jane said.
"Or waiting for the owners of coal mines to stop selling their product voluntarily," Sarah said.
"Ladies, there is not a man alive who would want this kind of change," Art responded.
"Of course not," Jane stated. "They'd think they're less of a man if they're not ready to rape and pillage."
Art usually avoided all arguments. Too much emotional intensity. But now, he was angry.
"I am not like that. And Walt's not like that either. He hates war."
"You're right, Art," said Sarah. "But that leaves way too many men driven by their biology."
"Well, just target those men then," Art said.
"Can't do it. It's hard enough to just target one gender," Sarah said. "But it's impossible to target a specific subgroup of men."
Neither Jane nor Sarah had seen Art mad before. His face was red and his voice was raised.
"Jane, this is wrong, and it's illegal as hell."
He wanted to say more, but his emotions left him tongue-tied. Instead, he stood, turned away, and, without a backwards look, stormed out of Ralph's. Jane watched him leave and said,
"He'll get over it."
"I don't know. I've never seen Art that mad. If our plan makes him so angry, other men are going to be totally insane."
Chapter 14. Vectors. Not since puberty had Mike felt such excitement. Back then, mating urges almost drove him crazy. But this was different. Mike felt wholly alive and engaged as he watched events unfold on the Earth. Will Art get over his anger? Could the Matthias Institute save the Earth? And of course, in the back of his mind, he was worried that Professor Ellisbach might discover his meddling with the humans. For the 100th time, he found himself wishing Garwig could be there with him. Unfortunately, the excitement interfered with his sleep. Usually, Mike spent a substantial amount of time hibernating. Why waste the energy? But now, too many thoughts raced through his brain. He checked and rechecked his data, and sent drones to collect more. Mike believed the humans were capable of doing their required genetic engineering. If not, he would offer more help. However, there was another problem. And this was a problem for which Mike had no solution. If Jane and Sarah were going to change the human genome, they needed a means, or vector, for getting the change into all 4 billion males at roughly the same time. Mike had no idea what sort of vector could implement this change. It required action on an enormous scale. They needed to cover the entire planet and infect all the males within just a few weeks. He could never manufacture enough mosquito drones to inject the whole male population. So Mike continued pondering, hoping that the humans would eventually discover a solution to the vector problem. Chapter 15. Art's Trip Home.
"Those women want to cut off my balls, and that is not going to happen!"
Art fumed as he walked down the street.
A cab pulled up. The cabbie rolled down his window and said, hey, pal, want a ride?
Bart looked up.
No. Thanks.
He had wanted to walk. This wasn't a great part of town, but his apartment was only 5 blocks away. The cab pulled off. Only then did Art notice the 3 men on the sidewalk behind him. Regretting not taking the cab, Art began walking faster and faster. The 3 men began to jog towards him, so Art broke into a run, but he was no match for his pursuers. Within a block, they'd caught him. One of the men grabbed Art's arm and shoved him into the brick side of a building. The men were young, maybe still in their teens. They wore dark-colored sweatshirts with hoods pulled over their heads, and they had him cornered.
Hey, man, why'd you make us run? Asked the tallest of the 3.
You know we were just going to catch you, said another.
What do you want?
Asked Art.
Just some fun,
said the tall one, smiling. Art pulled his wallet from his back pocket.
Just take it. Leave me alone.
The tall one took Art's wallet and then struck Art in the stomach. He doubled over in pain. The 3rd then kicked Art in the face, saying,
Wimp!
Art then collapsed to the concrete sidewalk. Fortunately for Art, a window opened above them on the 2nd floor, and a man yelled,
Hey, what's going on? You punks get out of here, I'll call the cops!
The 3rd man kicked Art in the ribs, and the 3 ran down the street, laughing. Early the following day, Gloria, Matthias's assistant, received a call from Wilson Memorial Hospital. She transferred the call to Jane.
Yes, this is Jane Parker.
This is Wilson Memorial Hospital. We have a patient here, Arthur Brown, who has listed you as his contact. Do you know him?
Certainly. Art works for me. Has something happened to him?
He was admitted last night with a concussion, 2 broken ribs, and a broken nose.
Oh, no. Can he have visitors?
Visiting hours for Mr. Brown start tomorrow at 10, room 403 in the orthopedic wing.
Saturday morning, Jane, Walt, and Sarah drove to the hospital and found their way to Art's room. When they entered, they saw Art lying flat on a hospital bed. He had 2 black eyes and a strip of white tape across his nose. Sarah hurried to his bedside.
Art, oh, I'm so sorry. How do you feel?
Terrible.
What happened?
Walt asked.
3 guys jumped me.
What do they want?
Sarah asked.
I gave them my wallet, but they said they wanted to have fun.
That's disgusting,
Jane said.
They were laughing and joking while they were beating me. Young men feeling their oats.
Oh, Art,
Sarah said. Art turned his head to Jane.
I've been thinking.
About what?
Jane asked, sensing a subtle change in Art's demeanor.
I've changed my mind.
You mean about men?
Jane asked. With surprising conviction, Art said,
Let's cut off their balls.
Chapter 16. Zombie Virus. 3 weeks later, Jane, Sarah, Walt, and Art gathered in a small conference room to brainstorm the vector problem. Sarah had told Walt about their idea for changing men, but unlike Art, he welcomed a project that might end war. Jane said,
Thanks to our anonymous friend, Mike, we understand the germline changes we want to make, but we still don't have a way to get the changes into men. We can't just walk around with pockets full of hypodermic needles injecting all the men we see.
Sarah laughed.
It's a good way to wind up in jail. How about retroviruses? They're very good at entering cells and changing human DNA. Why don't we use one of them as the vector?
Art said,
We could disperse the virus in the upper atmosphere and let the jet stream send it around the world. But there are problems. The upper atmosphere is cold and dry and gets a lot of ultraviolet radiation from the sun. I don't know how long viruses could stay alive up there. But even if a virus does stay alive, there's another problem. Immunity. Some men's immune system have already encountered every virus we could find, and thus would attack and destroy said virus.
So, what we need, Jane said, is a completely unknown virus that is robust enough to live in the upper atmosphere for a month or two.
That's about it, Art said.
Do you have any ideas?
Sarah asked. Jane said,
maybe. At least I have an idea about where to find an unknown virus. Have any of you heard of zombie bacteria? I thought that idea had been debunked,
Sarah said. Several years ago, Walt responded, 600 Russian reindeer were killed by a zombie anthrax bacteria that had been frozen for 800 years. Jane nodded her head.
The idea of zombie bacteria has been debunked. Almost all bacteria need a warm, moist environment. Anthrax turned out to be an exception. It hides out in the soil. But I'm thinking viruses might be another exception.
Sarah finished the thought.
They're simple organisms. Just some nucleic acid and a protein shell. They might be able to survive. We'd be looking for a zombie virus.
Art, who loved vacationing in remote cold places, asked,
So we're headed for the Arctic Circle? Siberia?
Not on Siberia. Too much red tape.
Jane paused and thought.
Matthias is going to want to know what's going on. I'm going to need a cover story that'll hold up until we can get a sample.
Jane looked at Art. She knew he loved to backpack in Alaska.
Art, how about an Alaskan vacation? We're going to need samples of soil down about 100 meters or more. Get them from well below the normal freeze-thaw line.
Why so deep? Walt asked.
Freezing and thawing cycles are destructive for any organism. We'd have better luck with a sample that stayed frozen.
How big a sample do you want? Art asked.
Drill 3 cores in different locations, pack them in dry ice, and send them to me by overnight express. I'll pick up the tab.
Art smiled and said, You got it.
And that brings this episode to a close. Boy, howdy, are things starting to get deep for Mike. He's finally decided to throw in on the side of the humans, helping them out with a solution to the aggression and tribalism problem, not without fears of being discovered by his own race, mind. And so much has happened with our 4 geneticists. Jane has gotten fully behind a problem that she likes. Sarah has become pretty enthusiastic about it as well. Walt has also become interested, but his major part doesn't come till a bit later. And Art, while starting off vehemently against the plan, due to a pretty heavy beating by some pretty nasty young men, he has come about and thrown in completely with the idea of tamping down the aggression of men. They even found out about a possible route of infection using so-called zombie viruses and a distribution using some of the upper layers of the atmosphere and the jet stream. The plan is coming together. Stages are being set. What are the problems that will crop up next? How is Mike going to deal with the breaking of his race's most sacrosanct law, the no-contact rule? Things continue in the next episode. Well, that's all for now. I'll be bringing the next episode up soon to answer all these questions and more. So until next time, farewell.
If you'd like to share your thoughts about the show, you have many ways to do so. You can send your feedback in text or audio to thegreathuntersnovel@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to read them or play them before the credits. You can also submit it to the website at www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Facebook page for the podcast and myself is www.facebook.com/performer.andrew.kaufman. If you like the book, please leave a review at Apple Podcasts and or podchaser.com. It really helps people to find the show. That's all for now. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. The book is copywritten 2024 by Gary Kaufman. The intro song is Jet Fueled Vixen by Kevin MacLeod from incompetech.com. and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. The outro song is Stay the Course, also by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com, and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. The contents of this podcast are copywritten 2024 by Andrew Kaufman and is released on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. So don't change or sell it, but you can share it all you want. For more information about these licenses, please visit creativecommons.org.